and welcome back to the Functional Nerds. This is episode 18, and we're the guys who like to get together each week and chat about technology, science fiction, and fantasy stuff, and music, of course, because with Anelio, it's all about the music. And then we record that and share it with you, our faithful listeners. My name's Patrick Hester. I am a blogger, an aspiring author, a podcast dude, and an all-around functional nerd. And my partner in crime on this thing is Mr. John Anelio. Say hello, John.
Hey, I'm John Anelio. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy topics. I have the Sci-Fi Songs blog where I post some of the songs that I record. And each week we usually have a third person with us. And this week we have two guests. The first guest we have is Mr. John DiNardo of the sci-fi blog SF Signal. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. How you doing? I'm John DiNardo, and you can find me at the group's blog, SF Signal. That's sfsignal.com, where we talk about all things related to the field of speculative fiction.
Yep. Now DiNardo's great, and we love him, but he's old hat.
I've been here.
Our second guest is a legend. Legend in the science fiction community, legend as an author. He's been nominated 34 times for the Hugo Award. He's won 5 of those nominations. He's won Nebula Awards, H-O-M-E-R. I don't know if that's actually Homer. I don't know how to pronounce that. So 24 nominations there, 10 wins. Asimov's Reader Poll Awards, Locus Awards, Golden Pagoda. The list goes on and on and on. Please help us in welcoming Mr. Mike Resnick to the Functional Nerds. Did you like that intro?
Yeah, I was impressed, especially by the cheers at the end.
I read that because John doesn't like reading things, and I didn't want him tripping up, which he does sometimes.
Before we go any further, I'd like to say something, and that is that John DiNardo and SF Signal deserve a place on the Hugo ballot for best fanzine, now that we're doing electronic.
There you go.
And I hope your listeners will remember to nominate him next year.
All
wow,
right.
Thank you. That's incredibly flattering. Like, my ego wasn't big enough. This is awesome. Thank you.
There's nobody harder working. Every day I go to SF Signal, and there's more stuff there than I can read in one sitting. And he never misses a day, and it's fascinating, and I love these mind meld things.
That's true.
Thanks for the kind words.
I will throw one thing out for you, Mike. He's been slacking off for, like, the last week and a half.
Hey, what, a guy can't go on vacation? What?
Well, you know where he lives. Beat the crap out of him.
Oh, my. See, I knew this was going to be a fun show, guys.
Yeah.
I knew it.
Okay, am I being dignified enough?
Oh, you're great. We love it. By the way, I see that you are from Chicago. Are you still in Chicago?
No. We lived in Chicago, my wife and I, our first 33 years, and we have lived in Cincinnati for 34.
I lived in Chicago my first 10 years. We were in the Berwyn-Cicero area. My dad had a restaurant on Cermak Road called Sorrento's.
Really? I remember eating on Cermak Road a number of times.
It was called Sorrento's. It was just down the street from San Odello.
I remember, well, there's a Sorrento's in Cincinnati, and there used to be one in Highwood, Illinois. I don't think I ate at yours.
It was just a pizza place. I remember there was a giant fire pit in the middle that kind of split the bar from the restaurant area.
No, that I didn't see. But I grew up probably a little earlier than you in Chicago. My father, we lived on the South Side. My father was a diehard White Sox fan. And before I was 8 years old, he had taken me to 100 doubleheaders, which means I saw Luke Appling and the Sox lose 190 games.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And we knew that there was a special team on the north side that played in vines and never had any lights, but we didn't know anything about them.
Well, I used to win tickets to that other team's games at school.
I lived and died with the Bulls once they started, but I left town before they got Michael Jordan. On the other hand, Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley, died 3 weeks after we moved to Cincinnati, and we figured we had gotten out of town just in time.
Well, I just
for WindyCon.
Gotcha. I just wanted to throw that out there because as I was doing a little bit of research on you, I saw that you had been in Chicago, and it's you know, my grandmother worked at the Oak Park Club. My dad ran Sorrento's. We were in that area. My aunt and uncle are still there. My grandmother, I think, died there. My grandmother on my dad's side lived within, you could see Wrigley Field from her house, which I always thought was really cool.
Well, I remember on TV, when they would show the Cub games, there were always people sitting on their roofs.
Yep.
And overlooking right field.
Yep. That was about the area that, my grandmother lived in.
Well, after we got married, we moved up to the North Shore, first to Highland Park and then to Libertyville. We were breeding and exhibiting collies, all of which were named after science fiction stories, I might add. And it was just too far to go for the games after that.
All right. Well, Mike, why don't we, you know, if you would indulge us, why don't you give us a little bit of a history of how you got started in writing and when you began and when you started selling stories for the first time?
Okay. I think I saw my first article when I was 15, which would have been in 1957.
Wow.
And my first story when I was 17, I wrote my way through college, through the University of Chicago. And I sold my first book when I was 20 or 21. And I never got a degree. The reason I quit college was I was freelance editing some men's magazines under a phony name. And I was also freelancing a lot of writing. And one week, I didn't have time to give my professor a new story. So I gave him one I had sold to Stag, a hairy men's magazine, as opposed to a naked lady men's magazine. And I had been paid like $500 for it. It'd be about $3,000 these days. And he gave me a C-. And at the same time, he sent the story to my men's magazine, not knowing I edited it. And it was so bad, I gave him a form reject. I thought... for 12 seconds, I quit college. I've never been back.
See, kids, you don't need college. Just start writing.
That's really what we're trying to tell people here.
I was married with a wife and a baby on the way. I was like 20 or 21 years old, something like that. And I looked for a job editing in Chicago, editing or writing, and the only thing open... was editing tabloids, which are kind of like the National Enquirer, only worse. So I edited them for 3 years and some men's magazines as well. And because my company didn't publish any paperbacks, any quote adult novels, I felt it wasn't a conflict of interest for me to start writing them. And I knew, you know, everybody in the field. So I began, and I had no idea at the time that how many of my contemporaries were doing the same thing. You can learn an awful lot about writing when you're producing a book every 4 days on deadline. Yeah. Bob Silverberg, everybody knows about that. Malzberg, I just found out Donald E. Westlake was one of us. Even Marion Zimmer Bradley wrote some lesbian novels. I must have done a couple of hundred of them over the next 8, 10, 12 years. And one day I turned to my wife in 1975 or 6 and said, you know, if I have to do, you know, one more 4-day book or one more 8-hour screenplay for Herschel Gordon Lewis, a dear friend, but you know what kind of films he made. You know, Blood Maniac, 2000 Maniacs, things like that. I said, my brain's going to turn to porridge and run out my ear. What else can we do to make a buck? And as I say, we were breeding and exhibiting collies very successfully at the time. We thought, well, you know, if the two of us can care for 15, 16 collies and have time enough left over for me to write, think of what a staff of 20 could do. So we went out looking for a kennel. We found the second biggest luxury boarding and grooming kennel in the country right here in Cincinnati, which is why I live here, and we bought it. And then at a much, much slower rate, I went back to writing science fiction, which I love. And I was sure that the kind of science fiction I wanted to write, not too many people wanted to read. And that's why we bought the kennel. And when the science fiction out-earned the kennel 3-4 years in a row, we sold the kennel, and all I've been doing is freelancing ever since.
Wow. That's amazing.
Now, do you think all of that work doing like the non-science fiction writing, do you think that really sort of helped to hone your writing chops and influence the way you wrote your science fiction later on?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, except for Malzberg, who signed his name to everything, most of us didn't want to be associated with this. I'm the only guy I wanted to know my name was the guy who made out the checks. Mm-hmm. But you learn an awful lot, as I say, not only about how to make a deadline when you're writing a book you're not thrilled with, but also how to differentiate characters. They all do the same thing. All the women looked alike. You had to do things to give them character, and it helped in later writing. You tried to make it as different as you could. You tried to be creative. Of course, nobody cared about the creativity. Can I take about 2 minutes and give you an example?
Sure.
Please.
All right. A fellow called Paul Neimark and I, he later wrote She Lives, which was a bestseller. We were laboring in the field together, and since neither of us liked writing these things, we would collaborate. So, you know, we were willing to take half the money if we only had to do half the words. And some James Bond parodies. One of them, I might as well say the name, you know, 50 years later, who cares, 45. It was called Boldfinger.
And Goldfinger.
What we did was we flipped a coin at the beginning of each book, and the winner got to do the three quarters of the book that had character and plot and stuff like that that the readers didn't care about, and the loser got to do the one quarter of the book that was sex scenes. And I won that toss. So I wrote it, a very funny, Thorne Smithian kind of James Bond book, and then he went back and put in all the sex scenes. You know, how funny was this? Well, 20 years later, Marvin Kaye comes up with an idea for an anthology called The Resurrected Holmes. And the conceit was that Watson dies in 1928 or 29. They find in his safe the notes for all the cases that are only referred to, like the giant rat of Sumatra and all. And they farm them out to the leading writers of the 20s. And each of us got to be one of the writers. So you get Holmes is written by Fitzgerald, is written by Hemingway. I chose to be Thorne Smith. And what I did was I took two chapters from Boldfinger where James Bond is trying to take a dead, naked lady across town on a bus. And it was really very funny. And all I did was change it to Sherlock Holmes. And I sold it for a top rate to a top anthology and got nothing but rave reviews on it. So my sex books weren't as bad as some people's.
So Mike, I noticed that like comedy kind of is a recurring theme, like with some of your writing over the years, isn't it?
Yeah, I love doing it. One of my bibliographers pointed out the other day that if you count the Lucifer Jones stories, they weren't always published separately, the first few books. But I've done 126 funny stories, which probably more than anybody except Sheckley. And yet, my reputation and my advances do not rest upon my humor. Although my favorite character, the stuff I would rather do than anything else, is Lucifer Jones. And my wife's favorite character, I invented them about 3 years ago and have sold them about 10, 12 times, is Harry the Book, a Damon Runyon-esque bookie in a fantasy New York. So I just love doing them.
I tell you what, I think humor in science fiction is underrated.
Oh, I think it is, and I really credit Bob Sheckley, who was my hero when I was a kid and my friend for 30 years, and finally, a year before he died, my collaborator. I credit him because prior to him, there was a lot of humor. There was Fred Brown and even Fred Pohl, Henry Kuttner, Fritz Lieber. They would do it occasionally, but Sheckley proved you could make a living doing it in science fiction, and without Sheckley, there's no Doug Adams, there's no Terry Pratchett, there's no Esther Friesner, there's probably only two-thirds of my body of work, but he proved it could be done. And this is the one field where I'm not aware that there's any, at least short fiction editor, who's ever turned a story down for being funny.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, I don't know, I could be completely wrong, but you know, when you talk about Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett, it seems like the English are more prone to put humor into their science fiction than American authors.
Yeah, well, also, you know, Doug and Terry live on the bestseller list, more power to them, and over in this side of the drink we don't, but there have been people who've done very, very well with humor here, John Sladek and the late Bob Asprin, and as I said, Esther, myself, a few others. but it has never sold that well here. The first half of the 20th century, humor was an honorable estate. You had Ring Lardner and Thorne Smith and H. Allen Smith and just a whole bunch of humorists. And it seems since the midpoint of the century, you've had maybe one guy at a time in the mainstream who could make a living writing humor. For a while it was Peter DeVries, for a while it was Max Schulman. There were never two. And science fiction is about the only place where you can find a lot of people who can still get away with it. And it feels like you're getting away with it when you sell it.
Do you find writing those stories are more fun? Does it mix it up for you? Or what's the appeal for you?
I certainly find they're much more fun. You know, they will not stay in print anywhere near as long as some of my other stuff, but I much prefer writing them. Funny stories are fun. Serious stories are a lot of angst.
Now, I'm not too, educated on this part of it, but are any of the major science fiction awards, do any of them have sort of a humor award? You know, I was wondering about that. You know, in acting, you know, sometimes there's like awards for best comedic actor or best comedic performance. Is there any awards for best comedy in science fiction?
Not anymore. There was for about 3 or 4 years in the mid-90s, and I'll be damned if I can remember the name of it now. It's listed somewhere in my bibliography because I was nominated once or twice. But that award went the way of the Gandalf Award and a whole bunch of other lesser ones.
I think it's kind of there's almost like a stigma attached to it now. It's like your science fiction has to be real and gritty and you know that kind of crap.
Yeah.
There's always been a strong school of criticism who was more than happy to tell the writers what their science fiction had to be. But usually the audience decides. Just an example, 25, 30 years ago, Bill Gibson, a fine, fine writer, created, in essence, cyberpunk. And a number of other writers tried it, and the critics just absolutely loved it. But the people didn't buy it except by Gibson. And about the same time, a lady named Anne Rice decided vampires were pretty sexy. And, you know, take a look at the newsstands or the bookstores today. There's got to be a vampire romance, I'm supposed to call them paranormal romances. There's got to be one published every day of the year. And if there are 5 cyberpunk books a year, that's a lot. So the public decides, you know, the new wave, old wave war was ended when the new wave didn't sell.
Mm. A good friend of mine, Trish Edmiston, she's a young adult writer, and she wrote this book. It was based a little bit on her life. It was about, you know, teenagers who have military parents and you know, kind of the trials and tribulations that they go through. And she had a publisher very interested, and they were going back and forth. And about the third or fourth round of, you know, kind of like, well, we want to publish it, we're not sure, you know, would you be willing to make some changes? She said sure. They said, could you make one of the kids a vampire? And her reaction was like, are you kidding me?
Well, you know, the wild part is, of course, they weren't.
Yeah.
I gather vampires are getting a little old hat. We're going to have very romantic zombies next year, which is even harder to imagine.
Brains.
Now, Mike, how did you come to publish through Pyre and Lou Anders? How did that relationship start? Because I know a lot of us have a connection to you through Lou. So how did that get going for you?
Well, Lou, the first time I'd ever met him or heard of him, he was editing the Resurrected Argosy, which was a gorgeous magazine for 2 whole issues before it went belly up. And he had asked me to do one of my Lucifer Jones stories for him. Now, that makes me your friend forever, because Lucifer had been in hiatus for about 10 years. And I did one, and I was supposed to be doing one every issue, and it appeared in number 2, and there were no more issues. But we hit it off, became friends. I know he had sought me out because he loved the Kieran Yaga stories. And when he moved over to Pyre, I guess I was one of the first 2 or 3 guys he asked to write for him. And they were very accommodating, because when he told me what his top price was, I said, I can't do that. I mean, I want to work with you, but I got to pay my bills, and my creditors have expensive tastes. And I said, how about if I give you a novel and a collection? And you pay me the same? Would you pay me the same for the collection as a novel? So he comes back a couple of days later and says, yeah. I said, okay, we're agreeing on the price for two books. Now, I want 85% for the novel and 15% for the collection. This establishes my novel price with you. It also means I'll make some royalties off the collection. Again, he went to his people. They said yes, and we've been in business ever since. I think I've done 11 books in 6 years for him.
Wow.
Yeah, now, said,
you just have to find ways to accommodate. If two people want to work together, they'll find a way.
Now,
it helps if you as an author have, you know, 60 novels, 18 collections of stories, 39 anthologies, and 219 pieces of short fiction under your belt.
It doesn't hurt. but by and large, you're about as good as your last book when you go to negotiate, or as your last book's sales.
Sure.
I like writing for Lou. He's certainly a fine editor. Nobody can doubt that. He's done things with I don't want to call it a minor line because he's turned it into a major one, but with minor budget and distribution compared to the mass market,
he's
just been remarkable. But there's some other guys I'm working with that I'm just as pleased with. One of them is Bill Schaefer over at Subterranean.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a guy that by any definition a couple of years ago you would have called a small press. But given that he's published me and Dan Simmons and Neil Gaiman and Ray Bradbury and George R. R. Martin, how can that be a small press? We're all very happy. We like our money and we like our sales with him. You don't find them in bookstores. He's got a phenomenal mailing list. But another guy I love working for. There isn't a New York mass market house I have not written for. And I liked them all. Yeah, it's hard not to like anybody who throws money at you and says, write me a book. But these two guys in particular, I've been very, very thrilled with. And, you know, possibly it's cost me a little money that I might have made, you know, staying only with mass market. But I'm very, very happy writing for them.
Now, Mike, I heard you interviewed, I guess it was about a month or two ago on the Dragon page. And you and both of the Mikes there were talking about. That was a great interview. And one of the things that I enjoyed was just how you're talking about how now you're probably more prolific now than you ever were. Can you talk a little bit about that? About how, you know, why do you think you're writing more now than ever?
Well, it's real simple. I am a writer. That's how I define myself, not as a husband, not as a father, not as an American citizen. I'm a writer. That's what I do. That's what I am. I love doing it. Most writers hate writing and love having written. I love writing. I'm 68 years old. I am a lot closer to the end than to the beginning, and I've still got a couple of hundred stories to tell. So, you know, whereas 20 years ago, I was very happy to write, you know, two books and six stories. I think last year I had 7 books and 14 stories. I got to get them all out.
Jeez.
And I keep doing that. I'm probably averaging 4 or 5 books. I mean, not all new novels. Some are collections, some are other things. But 4 or 5 books and about 15 stories a year in my dotage.
That's fantastic.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. You know, what do you think about in terms of, you know, I think about this a lot as a creative person about, and it might be a little highfalutin, you seem like a pretty down to earth person, but about in terms of like your legacy, like is it just because you like that, or do you like to sort of look back on what you've written and just sort of feel like you've contributed to the world? Is that any part of what you think when you're doing this?
Actually, no.
Okay.
I think about occasionally between books or when I'm laying in bed in a photo.
Sure.
But no, I'm realist enough to know that as good as my agent is, and I think she's the best, and as many fans as I have, you know, 15, 20 years after I'm dead, nobody will know I was here. Nobody will care. I'm just doing this because it's important to me. I would love to think that, you know, 85 years from now, somebody would pick up one of my books and enjoy it, but that's not anything I can realistically count on.
Mm. Interesting. Now, another question I had for you, too. A couple weeks ago on our podcast, we had John Picasso, who's done the artwork and the covers for several of your books at this point. I wanted to know, first of all, what you thought of those covers, and because I know a lot of times authors don't have a lot of input into what gets put on their covers, and what your feeling is about sort of other people who have to do with the sort of outcome of your books in terms of, you know, the art and all the other things that go into it.
I have been blessed over the years with nothing but fine cover artists. Some of their work I like better than others, but my first two books were illustrated by Jeff Jones and Kelly Frias. And over the years, I've had Whalen and Eggleton and Jim Burns over in England and Picasso and really fine new artist Dan Dos Santos. I just can't object to any of them. And besides, it's not up to me to object. It's up to the art director. And oh, by the way, if I can put in a plug, Lou Anders is the best damn art director I ever saw. He was double duty over there because they don't have an art director, and if they ever get one, instead of using him, they're crazy.
We absolutely love Lou. He was on the show. He was fantastic. And John Picasso was telling us, you know, about the skill that Lou has shown as an art director. You can definitely see it when you look at the covers of the Pyre books. That's one of the things that John and I have talked about for weeks, is that, you know, those books stand out. They stand out in the crowd.
Absolutely they do. I'm thrilled with him. One of the things that happens when you move to places like Pyre and Subterranean is that first you get paid on time, which you never get from New York. But secondly, artists actually ask you for input. Whereas in New York, you never know who your artist is going to be or what it's about. Your editors are willing to let you try things that frighten the hell out of New York mass market. I'm not saying I'll never write for mass market again. I do it all the time, but I am really, really pleased writing for people like Lou and Bill Schaefer, and I can toss in another gay name, Gary Turner over at Golden Griffin, who's done a couple of omnibus books on my suggestion that I could never have sold to New York.
It's almost as if, you know, moving to these, and I think one of the terms for them is like the specialty presses that are kind of coming up, is almost giving you more of a sense of a small community of support, you know, because you have someone like Lou who is there for you and can help you, and then you have the artists working together with you. It sounds like a completely different environment.
It's a pleasanter workplace. At this point in my career, I don't really need support. I can go out and sell just about anywhere, but I'm happy selling here. And I've always tried to support the small press. I've never, until Lou came along with some money, I've never been able to give one of them an original novel. But over the years, I have given books to Nesfa Press and Wisfa Press and Wildside, and there must be 10 or 15 of them. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for them, probably because I came up through fandom and I'm still a fan. You know, the writing is how I make my living. Fandom is what I do.
What do you think about the ebook market that's coming up?
I am thrilled by it. Now, I am a computer semi-literate after all these years, but lately, just in the last month or two, in fact, I have put 26 reverted titles, novels, up for sale on Kindle, and I can't believe how well they're doing and that they're paying 70% royalties. Hmm. Now, think about that, any writers who are listening here. You don't have to sell as well as your print books. You can sell 1/6 as well and make more money. Hmm. Furthermore, Amazon and Apple pay you instantly, whereas, again, you know, this is not only my complaint, it's standard operating procedure. You know, New York publishers tend to pay you 4 months late. I'm not kidding. I've had more than one editor tell me they found out years ago that you couldn't get into court to sue them for their, your money for 5 months. So they know you're not going to hire a hotshot lawyer if you know you're getting paid in 4 months. It gives them, with two royalty statements a year, an eight-month float on your money. Now, an eight-month float on my money isn't anything to write home about, or on yours. But on 800 people for a publisher, that's the difference between either profit and loss or profit and more profit. And, you know, it's the same thing. When you sign a contract, the contract says you're supposed to be paid that day. I don't know anybody's ever been paid within 3-4 weeks of it, et cetera.
Hey, Mike, I find it a little surprising that you said your computer is semi-literate, given that the work that you were doing with Bain's Universe. I kind of always got the impression as a reader that you guys were always, you know, kind of at the forefront of electronic, you know, press. How are your experiences there?
My job, which was a delightful job, was editing. People would send me stories. I would decide what stories to buy. I would make them better if I could. I would solicit some. But I had nothing to do with putting them up or formatting them or anything the way the page looked. Neither did Eric, by the way. That was done by a separate team that was strictly in charge of, you know, the way it looked, the graphics, all that. I believe Dave Freer was our art director, and a couple of other guys were really in charge of, you know, getting the stuff up and making it look good.
I always thought it was some high quality stuff. I mean, it was always well received.
Well, we tried. I think what the problem was, we had the wrong model. It was the right model when Jim Bain conceived it. He died, I think, a month into it, and I didn't join until the second year. But when he thought of it, he was willing to spend the money. We were paying 25 cents for our top rate, which is three times what Analog, Asimov, and FNSF pay, and we were paying 8 cents for our absolute bottom-of-the-barrel newcomer writer rate, which, again, was what the prozines were paying. We were doing 200,000 words when they were doing about 110,000. And if our competition had been Asimov, Analog, and FNSF, I think we would have made it, and made it very big. But by the time I joined a year later, our competition wasn't that. Our competition was Subterranean Press and Clark's World and 10 other guys who were all paying pro rates and were free. And we were charging $4.95 an issue. And, you know, for $4.95, we could compete with the digest. We couldn't compete with all these wonderful zines on the line, on the network, who were free. And that killed us after, well, we stuck around 3 more years, but we didn't make any money after the first year.
It's really rough to make money on the web that way.
Yeah, as I say, when we were the only one, it made sense. But, you know, by the time I joined, Subterranean was running John Scalzi and me and Elizabeth Baer and Joe Lansdale in every issue free. Clark's World was running all kinds of stuff. Toby Bacall, and again, me and Kitch Johnson, free. And we had some wonderful authors, but how the hell could we charge for them? Right. And that was the problem.
Yeah, I was at ReaderCon this past weekend, and there was a lot of discussion about sort of the state of magazines. And Neil Clark from Clark's World was there, and John Joseph Adams, who has recently started Lightspeed. That's the name of that magazine, I believe. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because, you know, there's a lot of heated discussion about stories on the web versus print, and is one against the other? Do they complement each other? And it seems like the overall feeling was that it's going forward, it's going to be a blend of the two, of online and of print. But it was interesting to be around some of those folks that you just mentioned, because, you know, it's important to a lot of up and coming writers and the fans. I think people want this stuff now, and especially with all of the new devices, with your Kindle and your iPhone and your iPad. I think there's sort of a new place for especially short fiction that I think on these devices, it really becomes a great way to consume this kind of thing.
Well, there's something else that counts too. Until a couple of years ago, it was considered all but impossible to make like a Hugo ballot with an electronic story.
that it had to come out of a top anthology or one of the Digest magazines. But now I made it twice out of Bane's Universe, and Kids Johnson just won a Nebula out of Clark's World. Other people are getting on ballots out of that. I think that's going to make a big difference. One of the problems that the online zines had, and I know that because I was editing one of them, was convincing top writers to give us their very best work. Because, you know, when you write a story that you know is award quality, you'd like to get nominated. You'd like a shot at the award. And they were just sure they couldn't do it out of an e-zine. Now they know they can.
John DiNardo, we've been cutting you off a lot. Have you have any questions for Mike here? Or?
No, that's fine. I'm sitting here in fanboy amazement just listening. This is great.
Well, Mike, then why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the current projects that you have that are out there right now, stuff that's come out in the past year or stuff that's about to come out.
Okay. Well, last December I finished up this five-book Starship series with one Flagship. It was a lot of fun to write. I'd never done military science fiction before. At one point, Pyre wanted me to write more of them, and I kept saying, you know, shouldn't we stop this before the author and the readers are both tired of it? And Pyre finally decided that wasn't a bad idea, so maybe the last one didn't sell as well as the first four. And then Lou asked me for a weird Western, and I didn't know what it was. And he said, well, you know, go look it up. It's a real term. I thought he was kidding me, so I went over to Wikipedia, and by golly, they got four pages about weird Westerns. And I decided to write him one. All my life, or at least all my adult life, I had wanted to write a novel about Doc Holliday and Johnny Ringo, the only two college-educated gunslingers in the West. And I just couldn't afford to do it. I can't write at beginner's prices anymore, and in the Western field, I'm a beginner. But suddenly, here was a chance to write one. It wasn't quite the novel I had in mind for 40 years, but I had 40, 50 books worth of reference, and I wrote a book called The Buntline Special, which is a weird Western for Pyre. It'll be out. It's got wonderful cover art. Be out in December, and it's about Doc Holliday and Johnny Ringo, and it's got a lot of weird stuff in it. They're calling it steampunk. I think weird Western probably defines it better. I've got a lot of brass and inventions in there, but like Bat Masterson is one of the undead, hence his name. And anyway, it was fun to write, and I suspect I'll be doing a sequel to it. Let's see what else. This summer, Barry Malzberg and I collected 26 of our dialogues that we've been doing for about 12 years on a quarterly basis, or now a bi-monthly basis, for the Science Fiction Writers of America Bulletin. And they're out from McFarland Press as The Business of Science Fiction. And I've got an omnibus volume I mentioned, made reference to earlier, coming out with a most unusual cover art I'll explain in a minute, from Golden Griffin in, I guess, October. It's called Blasphemy, and I have written a couple of novels that could be considered blasphemous. The Branch, which tells the story of the true Jewish Messiah who comes around 40, 50 years from now and is not really a nice guy, and neither is God. And before anybody will accept that, the book has to prove that Jesus isn't the Messiah. I kept sending copies of it when it first came out to every televangelist I knew in the hopes one would hold it up and say, buy this and you're going to hell, and I would be immediately, a bestseller. Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Falwell just wouldn't do it. So anyway, a few years before that, I think in 1982 or 3, I wrote one called Walpurgis 3. I had done 2 years of a weekly series on the supernatural for one of those tabloids I edited, so I knew a bunch about it, and I thought I would examine a world that was populated by Satanists and covens and all. Not that it works, but what the world would be like. So they're both short novels. Back then, 60,000 words was par for the course for a novel. And I talked to Gary Turner about it, and he said, you know, do you have any blasphemous short stories to go with it? And sure enough, I had four or five stories where either Jesus or God had speaking lines. So we put them all together, and the title for the book is Blasphemy. And the cover art shows as evil and weird a Satanist as you're ever going to see in his robes with, in a dark place reading out of some mystic book, and Don Mates painted it, and the face is mine. So I'm a cover boy, finally. Anyway, that'll be out in October. I just did a most fascinating short story for a guy called Jeff Connor from IDW, which is more gaming and comic than anything else. But the original title of the book was Monster Mashup. He has a new title now. I seem to think it's Classics Dismembered or some such thing. Anyway, mine was called L and Al versus Himmler's Horrendous Hordes from Hell, in which L is Big L, Eleanor Roosevelt, half-naked warrior princess, and Al is Little Al Einstein, master sorcerer. And it was about 10,000 words. It might be as funny as anything I've ever done. It was a lot of fun to do. It's an interesting book. My frequent collaborator, who's up for a Campbell this year, you should all vote for her, Leslie Robin from Australia, has one in there. And I'll just give you the title, Android of Green Gables.
I think you're my new hero, sir.
Anyway, I have three or four Lucifer Jones stories backed up at Subterranean. I made a deal with Pete Crowther over in England for Postscript magazine, because, as I say, this other character, Harry the Book, my Damon Runyon-esque character, is my wife's favorite, that he'll run one in every issue until he has enough to do a collection. And I'm 8 stories ahead of him, so he doesn't have to run that many. And I just handed him one for the December issue. What else? A couple of novellas. I'll have a novella in the next issue of Subterranean Online called 6 Blind Men and an Alien. You've all heard the story of 4 blind men and an elephant. This is my version. And I have one that I really blew it on dates. It's called Shaka 2, a story of a almost reincarnation of Shaka Zulu about 500 years from now. And it might be about as powerful as anything I've written in the last 10, 12 years. And I sold it to Subterranean. They'll be running it next year, I guess. And then he, being friends with Pete Crowther, gave me permission to sell it to Pete over in England, who put it out as a standalone hardcover, although it's a novella. But he put it out on December 28th. That just killed any chance it had for a Hugo. So, because I really think it was good enough quality to do it. Anyway, those two novellas will be out. I thought I was all through writing about Africa, and Bill Schaefer is a goddamn good nagger. He got me to do Kilimanjaro a few years ago. He started nagging, and I kept saying, no, I'm never going to do it. And he said, well, would you do it for such and so? And I said, well, yeah, but not right away. And he'd hang up the phone, and like 3 minutes later, I got a notice from PayPal, the money's in my account. So I had to write it, and he does that every time he gets something from me.
That brings up a question. When did you fall in love with Africa?
Well, everybody's going to assume it's Edgar Rice Burroughs, because we got into science fiction fandom through the Burroughs door. But actually, there was a guy called Alexander Lake who wrote 2 books, one called Killers in Africa and one called Hunter's Choice, back in the early 50s. And I read them when I was 8 or 9 years old. And I always wanted to see Africa thereafter. In fact, one of my happiest moments was like 40 years later, I was able to bring both of them back in print. I have a series called The Resnick Library of African Adventure, and I bring back classic African hunting and exploring stories, and his were the first 2 I brought. They were just wonderful, but he was a very evocative writer, and it's very little of it is about blowing animals away. An awful lot of it is just funny stuff or amusing stuff. At one point, he had to capture 60 Barbary apes, so he left out some booze and got them all drunk. Right. And then he got just about torn to shred trying to pick up drunk but not unconscious Barbary apes that weigh 80, 90 pounds and toss them in cages. There's stories like that. Or, you know, every hunter talks about, you know, how you go out and, you know, kill such and such an animal. He finds that uninteresting. He tells you how to cook it after you kill it when, there, you know, you have no implements and no kitchen and no nothing. And as I say, I was always interested by it. And I probably wrote the first Lucifer Jones book, which is set in Africa, before I went there. I went there in the first time in 86. And since then, we've been to Kenya, I guess, four times. And wow. We've been to Tanzania, Malawi, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, for about 3 minutes in Namibia. And we got lost and got off on the wrong side of the river once. And Egypt. They don't like to be called Africans in Egypt. They're above all that. And I just love it there. And I figured, you know, why in the world should it be all give and no take? I, you know, I spent all this money going there and take all this time. Maybe I can write about it. And I had no idea I was going to write this much about it. But it just is so evocative. It gives me so many powerful ideas that I do it.
It was, for the longest time, that was the frontier. You know, people, that was where they dreamed about going. It was the dark continent. So, you know, I can totally see what you're talking about as far as it being evocative.
Well, you know, you're supposed to extrapolate alien societies when you're doing science fiction. It helps if you extrapolate them on something real, because if there are any aliens out there, they probably inhale ammonia, excrete bricks, and smell colors. We don't know anything about them. But the most alien societies I've ever found on this Earth are all in Africa, and I extrapolate from them when I'm writing science fiction, whether it's about Africa or not. There's just an awful lot of, I find, story material there. In fact, at one point, George Effinger, who felt that way about North Africa, and I decided we were going to build a fence, and nobody could write about North Africa except him, and nobody could write about Sub-Saharan Africa except me. And we thought we would give Central America to Lucius Shepard.
So, and that shows up in your writing, too. I mean, you know, you've used Africa or your travels, right, in general, for a lot of your stories, right? I mean it shows.
Maybe 8 or 9 novels that are either about Africa or about African analogs, and maybe 25 stories. So, Africa's paid me back. I wish I could do that about the IRS so they could pay me back. I haven't come up with anything yet.
You know what? I think you would be extremely fun to sit around a giant table having dinner with.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be at Dragon Con and World Fantasy Con this year, so think about it.
I'm serious. I mean, you're very, very personable.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm serious too. You know, any dealings I do with editors, I can do after midnight. Happy to meet anybody who wants to talk at mealtime.
All right. All right. Well, Mike, you know, thanks so much for joining us. We had a couple of other things if you felt like talking about. We had a little bit about your When Movies Were Movies pieces. I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that at all.
I'll talk about anything. You know, words are my trade.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I am a huge fan of Westerns, so I'm jazzed that you're writing about Westerns.
Well, my wife is the real Western fan. As a matter of fact, I don't think you can name a cowboy that she can't name their horse.
Well, I you know,
back to B movies when we were kids, and she just, if it's a Western, she loves it. And in fact, when I was doing a couple of screenplays in the mid '90s, Hollywood had hired me to essentially put Santiago and Widowmaker in the screenplays. She is so much better and so much more experienced watching action adventure films, Westerns and others, that I insisted she become my collaborator because she's much more visual. And if either of these ever get the screen, I don't know if they ever will after all these years, but if they do, every action scene is hers.
Wow. Very interesting. Well, when you talk about When Movies Were Movies, I get the feeling that you and I watch a lot of the same channels on television, which is Turner Classic Movies, American Movie Classics, et cetera, and so on.
Well, I watch Turner Classics. I don't watch American Movie Classics anymore because they have commercials. But on the other hand, we are subscribers to Netflix at the highest level. We get 5 at a time. So we probably get about, 10 a week, 40 a month. Now, most of them Carol watches. That's my wife. But I'll watch four or five.
I just, you know, the couple weekends ago, I got sucked into The Magnificent Seven. Great, great old Western, based on the Japanese movie The Seven Samurai.
I'm probably the only guy in the world who likes the American version better than the Japanese version, just because of the music.
I like the American version better.
Well, good for you. Elmer Bernstein did one hell of a score.
Yes. But I look at Hollywood today. I miss Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart.
Bogart was my Bogart was one of my favorites. My other favorite was Two Headed, Laurie and Green Street. Hmm. Separate, they were fine, but I have all eight or nine of the films they were in together, and they were just the Mutt and Jeff of international crime.
How do you decide which movies you're going to talk about?
I made a list from my video library so that I could refer to it if I had to, and then I just go through there and choose. Or not all the films from my video library, the ones I'd like to talk about. I try, with one exception, not to talk about anything less than 30 years old. The one exception, because it went direct to video and I thought most people hadn't seen it, was The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, which showed me that Bradbury, I always knew he could be sensitive, I knew he could be terrifying, I never knew he could be charming, just a charming, charming film. But outside of that, they all go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s. What had happened was I was at Icon this winter in New York, and the Hotel for the Writers was about 15, 20 miles away from the convention center. I don't know why. And Paul Levinson had a car, and I didn't. Of course, I had flown in. So he offered to drive me there. And as he was driving, he was telling me that he does these podcasts. He does one with TV reviews and one how to tell writers how to write, and suggested I might be interested in that. So when I got home, I looked at this Mevio.com where they appear. I thought, yeah, that'd be a lot of fun, especially since he assured me that if I was at all witty and interesting, I could get some ads. And in fact, I've gotten a number of advertisers now. And I decided to do 4 or 5 minute reviews of the movies. I didn't want to go on and on and on about them. And I do about 12 minutes on each of the how-to writing things. Many of the questions I pull from my old Ask Buana columns, which I did for 12 years, but I'm still waiting for enough people to write me new questions to fill up a whole episode or podcast or whatever the word is. But it's been a lot of fun. And usually I'll sit down once a week, do one writing one, which, as I say, is longer and a little more complex, and maybe 4 quick movie reviews at 5 minutes each. And then I put them up every few days, and as I say, they're fun. I'm going to be revamping my own webpage and moving it pretty soon. And at that point, I think I'll move these over to my own page as well.
There you go. You know, what's fantastic about that, number one, they're great. But number two, you talked about how you are not particularly computer literate. And yet, here you are podcasting.
Well, I had somebody tell me how.
But that's awesome.
Heard.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, talking about Chicago, I used to sit in my grandmother's house, and we would watch WGN on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and we would watch all these old movies. You know, the Charlie Chan movies, Topper.
I grew up at GN.
Yeah.
In fact, years and years ago, when he was touring the country in a play called JB, Basil Rathbone stopped off at WGN for a day or two and did introductions, video introductions, to every Sherlock Holmes, Charlie Chan, and Mr. Moto movie. And they ran those for years with his intros.
That's awesome.
Cool. Well, I think, you know, Mike, I don't know if you had anything else you want to talk about, but we're at about an hour, and that seems like a kind of nice place to wrap it up. I don't know if you guys had any further questions for Mike before we kind of signed off. John or Patrick?
John?
Yeah. I'm good.
Okay. All right. Well, Mike, you know, thanks so much for joining us. I think this is, you know, got to be one of our better shows. Thanks so much for sharing all of your stories. And I'm really curious to check out all the podcasts that you're doing and all of that. And anything else that you want to let people know about that you have out there before we finish up?
No, theoretically, they should be able to find them. If they can find your show, they can find my stories.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. Well, before we usually, when we leave, we all talk, we all give a little plug for the stuff that we're doing. You can find the songs that I write at scifisongs.blogspot.com, including The Ballad of Wilson Cole, which is a song that Lou Anders had commissioned to put in one of Mike Resnick's book, the aforementioned Starship Flagship. So the sheet music to that song is in the back of Starship Flagship in the appendix, and you can get the MP3 on my site for free. But if you haven't read the books, stop listening about 2 minutes in, because I spoil the whole series if you listen to the whole song.
Major giveaways in that song.
Major giveaway. Let's do about a minute of it, and then go and read the five books.
No, it's incentive to read the books. The books are good. You should go read the books.
Yeah,
I read three.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, I now have something to say. Based on that. I don't believe in surprise endings. I think they're cheap shots. I think the ending should be inherent in the beginnings and inevitable. I know that, for example, with the best-selling book I ever did, which was Santiago, every now and then a reviewer would say, well, I guessed it 100 pages before the end. And the answer is, you were supposed to. You know, myths are comforting in the retelling. I'm not trying to shock you. And, you know, when I do mystery novels, I've done a few, then I'm supposed to surprise you. When I do these, I'm not.
All right. Well, you heard it from Mike Resnick. Listen to the whole song then and enjoy it. And Mike, thanks so much for being, you know, I don't know how much, you know, because Lou had asked me to do that. And I don't know how much, you know, say you had in allowing that in there. But I appreciate you, you know, allowing my song to appear in your book. And it was great pleasure and honor for me to have it in there. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Would you like a quick 60-second or so story on why it's there?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Okay. I did the first Starship book. I handed it in. And Lou said, you know, this is great, but this is only, you know, this is 8,000-9,000 words short of where it should be. And I said, you know, I wasn't looking at words. I told the story. And we looked through it and we said, you know, this is too closely well-knit to pad it with 8,000 or 9,000 words. What can we do? And I said, well, DVDs always give you extra features. How about we give some extra features at the back of the Starship book? I can talk about Teddy Roosevelt, which is what the name of the Starship is. I can talk about the universe it's put in. I've put about 20, 30 books into that future. I can do other things. And it was such a hit that they insisted that every Starship book thereafter had to have 5 or 6 appendices. And I got a local girl who designs airplanes to design the Starship. And when Lou came in, he said, you know, I've got this great song. How about it? And I say, yeah, great. Commission it. We need more appendixes for the last book. And well, it slopped over when I was doing these stalking books, the funny fantasy detective ones, Stalking the Unicorn, Stalking the Dragon, Stalking the Vampire. If you look at those, they all have 4 or 5 appendices, too. Fire assumes that if they're going to buy a book from me, it's got to have 5 appendices. End of story.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Great.
Wow. For what it's worth, I enjoyed those appendices. I thought they were great.
I do, too.
To do. The most fun was the history of pirate queens.
Yes, yes.
That was great, yeah. Well, thank you. All right.
Mike, well, Mike, you're awesome. I just have to say, you're awesome.
Hey, I really should let you guys go, which is what people are always telling me. But
we're almost done. Trust me. Yeah. John DiNardo.
Yes.
Tell people about yourself and where to find you.
Oh, yeah. You can find my ramblings and those of my co-bloggers at sfsignal.com. We post all sorts of things related to science fiction, mostly, and fantasy and horror as well. We do interviews and news and book reviews and all sorts of good stuff. Post some fun videos. Stop by and check us out, sfsignal.com.
There you go. And all my stuff is at, I've got the Twitter feed. Of course, John has the Twitter feed as well. John Anilio, twitter.com/John Anilio. John DiNardo has twitter.com/sfsignal. Mike, don't you have a Twitter feed?
Yeah, but I don't know anything about it. I'm semi-literate.
Okay. Now,
when I make a similar post a podcast, I say something on Twitter. Otherwise, I'm never on it.
If you want to find him, go to Google and type in Mike Resnick Twitter, and it'll show up. My Twitter feed is twitter.com/ATFMB, which stands for All Things From My Brain, which is also the blog that I have where I post some things, www.atfmb.com. And I have my serialized science fiction that comes out every Friday. That's at atfmb.com/EVERMIST. We also have the functionalnerds.com or functionalnerds.com. And Scott, whose last name I cannot pronounce, and I apologize, Scott. He is 8-Bit Dad on Twitter, and he has taken over for me on doing the daily nerd news roundups, and he is awesome, and I really appreciate him. Anything else we can think of, John?
No, that's it. I think that was a good show. I think we should wrap it up right there.
That was an awesome show. Next week, we have Ellie Modisette Jr. coming on, so that should be good, too.
Okay, thank you. When you post this, email me a link.
I sure will, sir.
I know how to click on links. That's one of the few things.
I will send you a link, I promise. It'll go up on Friday.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Although this show did go much, much better this week Skype-wise, we did have a few little audio problems in the very beginning. Luckily, John DiNardo was around to save the day!
John D. here.
When he comes back, if he still doesn't have sound, I need you to walk him through Skype on a PC, going in and making sure that his audio is set up with his microphone. So I can't do that because I'm on a Mac and it's in a completely different place for me.
Yeah, it just works. I hear you. Blah, blah, blah.
I didn't say it just works. I just said it's in a different place.
Oh, we heard you loud and clear.
Right.
Elitist.
See if I ever help you test out your video chat again. And it didn't make much of a
pirate. Wilson was an honest man. Speaking of costumes and you being Apple fanboys, I was at ApolloCon a couple of weeks ago, and there was a guy in a kilt using an iPad. Thought that was kind of interesting.
Sweet.
Yes, they say Wilson Cole was a hero.
I use Skype and talk with my collaborator in Australia. We've never had a problem.
You're quite the prolific writer, so I'll know you'll appreciate this. At some point in my life, I hit a gypsy princess with my car. The tribe cursed me. As far as technology is concerned.
And then they turned you into a vampire who seduces young women and makes the bestseller list.
Right, no, they actually thought that would be too good for me.
Yeah, I've never understood this. I grew up thinking they were unclean, dead things that sucked your blood. I had no idea they were all romantic ideals. I blame Frank Langella for that.
It was that awesome 80s hair he had.
Yeah.
So, Mike.
That's the right word.
Yes, and vampires are now sparkly.
So, you've come to England, Count, to settle down.
To settle down? Oh, hardly that. I've come to wander through the crowded streets of London, or to be here, in the midst of the whirl and rush of humanity, to share its life, its change, its death.
I don't know that I especially love old movies, but I sure hate new ones. I saw a disc of Avatar, and all I know is somewhere I read that this guy kept the script in a safe for 6 years. It would have been better if he'd forgotten the combination.
I mean, this is great stuff. You should be recording.
Oh, John, I start recording immediately. It's all recorded. He kept up the fight and he did what was right as he led his fleet through the stars. Oh, my God.